Wilhelm fraternizing with officers of the Royal Navy, Wilhelm sailed on to the Norwegian coastal town of Balholm, where he remained anchored until the 25th of July. It was from here, on the 14th of July, that he sent a first personal reply to Franz Josef's message requesting German help. The letter reiterated the earlier assurance of support and denounced the crazed fanatics whose pan-Slavist agitation threatened the dual monarchy, but, interestingly enough, it made no reference to the waging of war. Wilhelm stated that although he must refrain from taking a view on the question of current relations between Vienna and Belgrade, he saw it as a moral duty of all civilized states to counter anti-monarchist propaganda of the deed with all the available instruments of power. But the rest of the letter referred exclusively to diplomatic initiatives in the Balkan region to prevent the emergence of an anti-Austrian Balkan League under Russian patronage. It closed with best wishes for the Emperor's swift recovery from his bereavement. The Kaiser's comments on the state papers that reached him on the yacht reveal that, like many of the leading political and military figures in Berlin, he was impatient to hear of a decision from Vienna. His chief concern appears to have been that allowing too much time to elapse would squander the benefits of international indignation at the Sarajevo murders, or that the Austrians might lose their nerve altogether. He was pleased to hear, on around the 15th of July, that an energetic decision was imminent. His only regret was that there would be a further delay before Austrian demands were delivered to Belgrade. On the 19th of July, however, Wilhelm was shocked into a state of high anxiety by a telegram to the Hohenzollern from the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Jago. The telegram contained nothing essentially new, but its warning that an ultimatum was now planned for the 23rd of July, and that measures were to be taken to make sure that the Kaiser could be reached in case unforeseen circumstances should make important decisions, mobilization, necessary, brought home to Wilhelm the potential scope of the crisis that now loomed. He immediately issued an order that the High Seas Fleet should cancel a planned visit to Scandinavia and instead remain together in a state of readiness for immediate departure. His anxiety was understandable, given that the British Navy happened at this time to be in the midst of a trial mobilization and was thus at a high level of battle readiness. But Beetman and Jago rightly took the view that this would merely arouse suspicion and exacerbate the crisis by discouraging a British demobilization. On the 22nd of July, they overruled Wilhelm and ordered that the sojourn in Norway proceed as planned. At this point, diplomatic priorities still outweighed strategic considerations. Despite the rising tension, Wilhelm remained confident that a more general crisis could be avoided. Presented with a copy of the text of the ultimatum to Belgrade, he commented, "Well, what do you know? That is a firm note, after all." Wilhelm had evidently shared the view widely held within his entourage that the Austrians would ultimately shrink from confronting Serbia. When Admiral Müller suggested that the ultimatum meant that war was imminent, the Kaiser energetically contradicted him. The Serbs, he insisted, would never risk a war against Austria. Müller interpreted this, correctly as it turned out, as a sign that the Kaiser was psychologically completely unprepared for military complications and would cave in as soon as he realized that war was a real possibility. Wilhelm returned to Potsdam on the afternoon of the 27th of July. It was very early on the morning of the following day that he first read the text of the Serbian reply to the ultimatum served by Vienna 5 days before. His response was unexpected, to say the least. He inscribed on his copy of the Serbian reply the words, "An excellent result for a 48-hour deadline. This is more than we could have expected, but this does away with any need for war." He was astonished to hear that the Austrians had already issued an order for partial mobilization. "I would never have ordered a mobilization on that basis." At 10 o'clock that morning, the Kaiser dashed off a letter to Jago in which he declared that since Serbia had tendered a capitulation of the most humiliating kind, any reason for war has now been eliminated. "Instead of invading the country outright," he went on, they should consider temporarily occupying the evacuated city of Belgrade as a means of ensuring Serbian compliance. More importantly, Wilhelm ordered Jago to inform the Austrians that this was his wish, that every cause for war had vanished, and that Wilhelm himself was prepared to mediate for peace with Austria. "This I will do in my own way, and as sparingly of Austria's national feeling and of the honour of her arms as possible." He also let Moltke know in writing that if Serbia abided by her undertakings to Austria-Hungary, the grounds for war would no longer exist. During that day, according to the Minister of War, he made confused speeches which give the clear impression that he no longer wants war and is determined to avoid it, even if it means leaving Austria-Hungary in the lurch. Historians have seen this sudden bout of circumspection as evidence of a failure of nerve. On the 6th of July, when the Kaiser had met Gustav Krupp in Kiel, he had repeatedly assured the industrialist, "This time I shall not chicken out." Krupp was struck by the pathos of these feeble attempts to prove his mettle. As Luigi Albertini aptly put it, "Wilhelm was full of bluster when danger was a long way off, but piped down when he saw a real threat of war approaching." There is something in this. The Emperor's readiness to commit himself to the defence of Austrian interests had always been inversely proportional to his assessment of the risk of conflict. And on the 28th of July, the risks appeared very grave indeed. The latest telegrams from Lichnowsky in London reported Sir Edward Grey as saying that Serbia had given satisfaction to a degree he would never have believed possible, and warning that a major conflagration was in prospect if Austria did not moderate its position. Hypersensitive as he was to the British viewpoint, Wilhelm must have taken these warnings seriously. Indeed, they may even account for his interpretation of the Serbian reply, which was so at odds with the view of the Chancellor and the Foreign Office. In some respects, however, Wilhelm's note of the 28th of July was less out of line with his previous interventions than the idea of a failure of nerve might imply. His comments during the crisis suggest that, unlike those figures in Vienna and Berlin who saw the ultimatum as a mere pretext for military action, he regarded it as an authentic diplomatic instrument with a role to play in resolving the crisis, and that he remained wedded to the notion of a political resolution of the Balkan problem. A fissure had opened within the German decision-making structure. The view of the sovereign was at odds with that of the most senior political decision-makers. But the fissure was soon closed. The most remarkable thing about the letter to Jago of the 28th of July is that it was not acted upon. Had Kaiser Wilhelm II enjoyed the plenitude of power that is sometimes attributed to him, this intervention might have changed the course of the crisis and possibly of world history. But he was out of touch with developments in Vienna, where the leadership was now impatient to press ahead with the strike on Serbia. And, more importantly, having been away at sea for the better part of 3 weeks, he was out of touch with developments in Berlin. His instructions to Jago had no influence on Berlin's representations to Vienna. Bethmann did not inform the Austrians of Wilhelm's views in time to prevent them from issuing their declaration of war on the 28th of July. And the Chancellor's urgent telegram to Chirschke, dispatched only a quarter of an hour after the Kaiser's letter to Jago, incorporated some of Wilhelm's proposals, but omitted the crucial insistence that there could now be no reason for war. Instead, Bethmann stuck to the earlier line, since abandoned by Wilhelm, that the Germans must avoid very carefully giving rise to the impression that we wish to hold the Austrians back. Why Bethmann did this is difficult to establish. The view that he had already harnessed his diplomacy to a policy of preventive war cannot be supported from the documents. It is more probable that he was simply already committed to an alternative strategy that focused on working alongside Vienna to persuade Russia not to overreact to Austrian measures. On the evening of the 28th of July, Bethmann persuaded the Kaiser to send a telegram to Nicholas II, assuring him that the German government was doing its level best to bring about a satisfactory understanding between Vienna and St. Petersburg. Only 24 hours before, Wilhelm had rejected such a move as premature. The result was the note mentioned earlier to Nicky, begging him not to compromise Willy's role as intermediary. Beatman was thinking in terms of localizing the conflict, not of preventing it, and he was determined to protect that policy against interventions from above. From the 25th of July onwards, there was growing evidence of military movement in Russia. The intelligence officer in Königsberg reported that an unusually long batch of encrypted transmissions had been intercepted between the Eiffel Tower and the Russian wireless station at Babrusk. On the morning of Sunday, the 26th of July, Lieutenant General Chelius, the German military plenipotentiary to the court of Nicholas II, reported that the authorities appeared to have inaugurated all preparations for mobilization against Austria. In order to acquire a fuller picture of what was happening across the border, Major Nikolai of Department 3B returned to Berlin, cut short his holiday leave, and issued orders that the tension travelers, Spannungsreisende, were to be mobilized. These were volunteers from a range of backgrounds whose task was, at the first sign of international tension, to enter Russia and France under the guise of vacationers or commercial travelers and record covert observations in order to establish, as Major Nikolai put it in their brief, whether war preparations are taking place in France and Russia. Some of them made repeated short trips across the border and reported their observations in person, like the indefatigable Herr Hennumont, who managed to visit Warsaw twice in the space of 3 days and was trapped for a time in Russian Poland when the borders closed. Others travelled further afield and sent lightly coded cables through the public telegraph service. There was, as yet, no sense of hurry. The intelligence officers handling the travellers were informed on the 25th of July that the period of tension might be quite protracted. If, on the other hand, the tension waned, those travellers whose leave had been cancelled would be able to go back on vacation. The tension travellers and other agents operating out of the intelligence stations on the eastern frontier soon began to generate a picture of Russian military preparations. From the station at Königsberg came reports of empty freight trains moving eastwards, troop movements around Kovno, and alerts to frontier guard units. At 10 p.m. on the 26th of July, tension traveller Wensky reported from Vilna, using the commercial telegram service, that war preparations were already well underway in the city. Throughout the 27th and 28th, a steady flow of details from tension travellers and other agents reached the newly created Intelligence Assessment Board at the General Staff. On the afternoon of the 28th of July, the board produced an appraisal summarizing the latest information to hand. Russia apparently partial mobilization, extent not yet discernible with certainty. Military districts Odessa and Kiev fairly certain. Moscow still uncertain. Isolated reports regarding mobilization of the Warsaw military district not yet verified. In other districts, notably Vilna, mobilization not yet ordered. Nevertheless, it is certain that Russia taking some military measures also on the German border, which must be regarded as preparation for a war. Probably proclamation of her period preparatory to war proclaimed for the whole empire. Frontier guard everywhere equipped for combat and ready to march. This dramatic worsening of the situation, further reinforced by the news of partial mobilization on the 29th of July, injected an element of panic into German diplomacy. Worried by messages from London and by the steady stream of data on Russian military preparations, Beatman suddenly changed his tack. Having undermined Wilhelm's efforts to restrain Vienna on the 28th of July, he now attempted to do so himself in a series of urgently worded telegrams to Ambassador Chirsky the next day. But his efforts were rendered futile in their turn by the speed of Russian preparations, which threatened to force the Germans into countermeasures before mediation could begin to take effect. After the news of Russia's mobilization on the 30th of July, it was merely a matter of time before Berlin responded with military measures of its own. 2 days earlier, the Minister of War, Erich von Falkenhayn, had succeeded, after a struggle with Beatman, in getting troops in training areas ordered back to their bases. The early preparatory measures ordered at this time buying wheat in the Western attack zone, setting special guards on railways and ordering troops to garrisons, could still be kept secret and could thus, in theory, proceed in parallel with diplomatic efforts to contain the conflict. But the same did not apply to the State of Imminent Danger of War, SIDW, the last stage of preparedness before mobilization. The question whether and when Germany should adopt this measure, which had been in force in Russia since the 26th of July, was one of the central bones of contention within the Berlin leadership during the last days of peace. At a meeting on the 29th of July, the day of Russia's partial mobilization, there was still disagreement among the military chiefs. Falkenhayn, the Minister of War, was in favor of declaring the SIDW, while the Chief of the General Staff, Helmut von Moltke, and Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, were for merely extending guard duties on important transport structures. The Kaiser appears to have oscillated between the two options. In Berlin, as in St. Petersburg, the deepening concentration of the political leadership on momentous and controversial sovereign decisions enabled the head of state to re-emerge as a central participant in the policy-making process. The telegram Wilhelm had received that morning from the Tsar threatening extreme Russian measures that would lead to war disposed him at first to support the Minister of War. But, under pressure from Bethmann, he changed his mind, and it was decided that the SIDW would not be declared. Falkenhayn regretted this outcome, but noted in his diary that he could understand the motivations for it, because anyone who believes in, or at least wishes for, the maintenance of peace can hardly support the declaration of the threat of war. On the 31st of July, after further wavering over military measures, news arrived from Ambassador Portales in Moscow that the Russians had ordered total mobilization from midnight on the previous evening. The Kaiser now ordered by telephone that the SIDW be declared, and the order was issued to the armed forces by Falkenhayn at 1 p.m. on the 31st of July. The responsibility for mobilizing first now lay squarely with the Russians, a matter of some importance to the Berlin leadership, who were concerned, in the light of pacifist demonstrations in some of the German cities, that there should be no doubt about the defensive character of Germany's entry into war. Of particular concern was the leadership of the Social Democrats, SPD, who had secured more than a third of all German votes in the last Reichstag elections. Bethmann had met on the 28th of July with the right-wing SPD leader, Albert Südikum, who had promised that the SPD would not oppose a government obliged to defend itself against Russian attack. Anti-Russian feeling was as strong within the SPD as it was in the British liberal movement. On the 30th of July, the Chancellor was able to reassure his colleagues that they need not fear, in the event of war, subversion from within by the organized working class. In view of developments in Russia, Wilhelm could hardly continue to block declaration of the SIDW, but it is interesting to note that, according to the testimony of the Bavarian military plenipotentiary von Wenninger, this decision had to be wrung out of him by Falkenhayn. By afternoon, the sovereign had regained his sangfroid, mainly because he had persuaded himself that he was now acting under external constraint, a matter of great import to nearly all the actors in the July crisis. During a meeting at which War Minister Falkenhayn was present, Wilhelm gave a spirited exposé of the current situation, in which the entire responsibility for the impending conflict was laid at Russia's door. His demeanour and language, Falkenhayn noted in his diary, were worthy of a German emperor, worthy of a Prussian king. These were striking words from a soldier at the forefront of those hawks who had excoriated the monarch for his love of peace and his fear of war. When the Russian government refused to rescind its mobilization order, Germany declared war on Russia on the 1st of August 1914. There must be some misunderstanding. During the last days of July, the German Kaiser's attention remained focused on Britain. This was partly because, like many Germans, he saw Britain as the power at the fulcrum of the continental system, upon which depended the avoidance of a general war. Wilhelm shared in a broader tendency both to overestimate Britain's weight in continental diplomacy and to underestimate the degree to which its key policymakers, Grey in particular, had already committed themselves to a specific course. But there was surely also a psychological dimension. England was the place where Wilhelm had desperately sought, but only sometimes achieved, applause, recognition, and affection. It represented much that he admired: a navy equipped with the best guns and equipment that modern science could build, wealth, sophistication, worldliness, and, at least in the circles he encountered on his visits, a kind of aristocratic, poised comportment that he admired but found impossible to emulate. It was the home of his dead grandmother, of whom Wilhelm later remarked that, had she lived on, she would never have allowed Nicky and George to gang up on him like this. It was the kingdom of his envied and detested uncle, Edward VII, who had succeeded, where Wilhelm had failed, in improving the international standing of his country. And, of course, it was the birthplace of his mother, now dead for 13 years, with whom he had had such a troubled and unresolved relationship. A tangle of emotions and associations was always in play when Wilhelm attempted to interpret British policy. The Kaiser was hugely encouraged by a message from his brother Prince Henry of Prussia on the 28th of July, suggesting that George V intended to keep Britain out of the war. Early on the morning of the 26th, Henry, who had been yachting at Cowes, rushed to Buckingham Palace to take his leave from the British king before returning to Germany. A conversation had taken place between the two men, in which Henry claimed that George V had said, "We shall try all we can to keep out of this, and shall remain neutral." These words were cabled to the Kaiser as soon as the prince reached Kiel Harbour on the 28th of July. Wilhelm viewed this statement as tantamount to an official assurance of British neutrality. When Tirpitz challenged him on his reading, Wilhelm replied, with a characteristic blend of pomposity and naivety, "I have the word of a king, and that is enough for me." Whether the British king had, in fact, uttered these words is unclear. His diary is predictably uninformative on the subject. It states simply, "Henry of Prussia came to see me early. He returns at once to Germany." But another account of the meeting, probably composed by the monarch at the request of Edward Grey, provides more detail. According to this source, when Henry of Prussia asked George V what England would do in the event of a European war, the British monarch replied, "I don't know what we shall do. We have no quarrel with anyone, and I hope we shall remain neutral. But if Germany declared war on Russia, and France joins Russia, then I am afraid we shall be dragged into it. But you can be sure that I and my government will do all we can to prevent a European war." There was, then, a stiff measure of wishful thinking in Henry's report of the exchange, though we cannot absolutely rule out the possibility that George V adjusted his own account of the meeting to the expectations of the Foreign Secretary, in which case the truth may lie somewhere between the two. In any case, Henry's telegram was enough to replenish the Kaiser's confidence that Britain would stay out, and his optimism seemed to be borne out by the reluctance of the British government, and specifically of Grey, to make known their intentions. Wilhelm was thus shocked to learn on the morning of the 30th of July of a conversation between Grey and the German ambassador, Count Lichnowsky, in which the former had warned that whereas Britain would stand aside if the conflict remained confined to Austria, Serbia, and Russia, a bizarre notion, it would intervene on the side of the Entente if Germany and France were to become involved. The ambassador's dispatch provoked a rush of enraged jottings from the German monarch. The English were scoundrels and mean shopkeepers who wanted to force Germany to leave Austria in the lurch, and who dared to threaten Germany with dire consequences while refusing to pull their continental allies back from the fray. When news arrived of the Russian general mobilization on the following day, Wilhelm's thinking turned once again to Britain. Seen in combination with Grey's warnings, the Russian mobilization proved to Wilhelm that England now planned to exploit the pretext provided by the widening conflict in order to play the card of all the European nations in England's favour against us. Then, shortly after 5 p.m. on the afternoon of Saturday, the 1st of August, came sensational news. just a few minutes after Berlin had issued the order for a general mobilization, a telegram arrived from Lichnowsky in London describing a meeting that morning with the British Foreign Secretary. It seemed that Grey was offering not just to stay out of the war if Germany refrained from attacking France, but to vouch for French neutrality as well. The text of the cable was as follows. Sir Edward Grey has just sent word to me by Sir W. Tyrrell that he hopes that he will be able this afternoon, as a result of a council of ministers that is just taking place, Lichnowsky dispatched the telegram at 11:14 a.m., to make a statement to me which may prove helpful in preventing the great catastrophe. To judge by a remark of Sir W. Tyrrell's, this seems to mean that in the event of our not attacking France, England too would remain neutral and would guarantee France's passivity. I shall learn the details this afternoon. Sir Edward Grey had just called me upon the telephone and asked whether I thought I could give an assurance that in the event of France remaining neutral in a war between Russia and Germany, we should not attack the French. I assured him that I could take the responsibility for such a guarantee, and he will use this assurance at today's cabinet meeting. Supplementary. Sir W. Tyrrell urgently begged me to use my influence to prevent our troops from violating the French frontier. Everything depended upon that. He said that in one case where German troops had already crossed the frontier, the French troops had withdrawn. Stunned by this unexpected offer, the decision-makers in Berlin got busy drafting a warmly positive reply to the note. But the draft was incomplete when a further telegram arrived from London at around 8 p.m. As follow-up to my previous telegram, Sir W. Tyrrell has just been to see me and told me that Sir Edward Grey wants this afternoon to make proposals for England's neutrality, even in the event of our being at war with France as well as with Russia. I shall be seeing Sir Edward Grey at 3:30 and shall report at once. The messages from London set the scene for a violent dispute between the Emperor and the Chief of the General Staff. The German mobilization was already underway, which meant that the vast machinery of the Schlieffen Plan was in motion. After seeing Lichnowsky's first telegram, Wilhelm took the view that although the mobilization order could not for the moment be revoked, he would be willing to halt any move against France in return for a promise of Anglo-French neutrality. Supported by Bethmann, Tirpitz, and Jago, he ordered that there were to be no further troop movements until the arrival of a further message from London clarifying the nature of the British offer. But whereas Wilhelm and Bethmann wished to seize the opportunity to avoid war in the West, Moltke took the view that, once set in motion, the general mobilization could not be halted. This gave rise to an extremely lively and dramatic dispute, one observer recalled. Moltke, very excited, with trembling lips, insisted on his position. The Kaiser and the Chancellor and all the others pleaded with him in vain. It would be suicidal, Moltke argued, to leave Germany's back exposed to a mobilizing France. In any case, the first patrols had already entered Luxembourg, and the 16th Division from Trier was following close behind. Wilhelm was unimpressed. He had the order put through to Trier that the 16th Division be halted before the borders of Luxembourg. When Moltke implored the Kaiser not to hinder the occupation of Luxembourg on the grounds that this would jeopardize German control of its railway route, Wilhelm retorted, "Use other routes." The argument reached a deadlock. In the process, Moltke had become almost hysterical. In a private aside to Minister of War Erich von Falkenhayn, the Chief of the General Staff confided, close to tears, that he was a totally broken man, because this decision by the Kaiser demonstrated to him that the Kaiser still hoped for peace. Even after the arrival of the later telegram, Moltke continued to argue that the mobilization plan could not, at this late stage, be altered to exclude France, but Wilhelm refused to listen. "Your illustrious uncle would not have given me such an answer. If I order it, it must be possible." Wilhelm ordered that champagne be brought in, while Moltke stomped off in a huff, telling his wife that he was perfectly prepared to fight with the enemy, but not with a Kaiser like this one. The stress of this encounter was such, Moltke's wife believed, that it caused the Chief of the General Staff to suffer a mild stroke. As the champagne corks flew from their bottles, Bietmann and Jago were still drafting their reply to the first cable from London. Germany would accept the proposal, they wrote, if England could guarantee with its entire armed strength the unconditional neutrality of France in a German-Russian conflict. The mobilization would continue, but no German troops would cross the French border until 7 a.m. on the 3rd of August, pending a finalization of the agreement. The Kaiser reinforced the message in a telegram of his own to King George V, in which he warmly accepted the offer of French neutrality under guarantee of Great Britain, and expressed the hope that France would not become nervous. The troops on my frontier are in the act of being stopped by telegraph and telephone from crossing into France. Jago, too, sent a telegram asking Lichnowsky to thank Grey for his initiative. Shortly afterwards, a new dispatch arrived from Lichnowsky. The eagerly awaited 3:30 p.m. appointment with Grey had in the meanwhile taken place, but, to the German ambassador's surprise, Grey had not offered a proposal for British or French neutrality, nor did it seem that he had raised the matter with his colleagues in cabinet. Instead, he merely hinted at the possibility that the German and French armies might, in the event of a Russian war, remain facing each other without either side attacking, and then focused on those German actions that might trigger a British intervention. In particular, Grey warned, it would be very difficult to restrain English feeling on any violation of Belgian neutrality by either France or Germany. Lichnowsky responded with a question that turned the tables on the Foreign Secretary. Would Grey be prepared to give him an assurance of Britain's neutrality if Germany agreed not to violate Belgian territory? Oddly enough, this overture caught Grey off guard. He was obliged to state that he could not give any such assurance, since England must keep its hands free. In other words, Grey appeared to be backing away from his earlier proposal. At the same time, he revealed, perhaps inadvertently, that he had made his proposal without consulting the French beforehand. In his account of this somewhat inconclusive conversation, Lichnowsky reported simply that the British did not appear prepared to make any engagement that would limit their freedom of action, but that Grey had agreed to inquire into the possibility of a Franco-German armed standoff. In Berlin, this dispatch, which arrived early in the evening, gave rise to general confusion, and no reply was sent. In the meanwhile, however, the Kaiser's telegram to King George V, warmly accepting his government's proposal of French neutrality, had reached its destination, causing consternation in London. No one, it seems, had been initiated into the twists and turns of Grey's operations that day, and the Foreign Secretary was summoned urgently to Buckingham Palace to provide an explanation and draft a reply. At around 9 p.m., he penciled the text that became George V's answer to Kaiser Wilhelm's telegram. There must be some misunderstanding as to a suggestion that passed in friendly conversation between Prince Lichnowsky and Sir Edward Grey this afternoon, when they were discussing how actual fighting between German and French armies might be avoided, while there is still chance of some agreement between Austria and Russia. Sir Edward Grey will arrange to see Prince Lichnowsky early tomorrow to ascertain whether there is a misunderstanding on his part. Any remaining ambiguity was dispelled by a further telegram from Prince Lichnowsky, who had received Jago's acceptance of the British proposal at around the same time as King George had received the exuberant telegram from his cousin. With deadpan clarity, Lichnowsky wrote, "Since there is no British proposal at all, your telegram inoperative. Therefore, have taken no further steps." By this time it was past 11 p.m. in Berlin. Relief was in sight for Moltke, who was at General Staff Headquarters, weeping tears of despair over the Kaiser's order halting the 16th Division. Shortly before midnight, Moltke was ordered back to the palace to hear news of the latest dispatch. On his arrival, Wilhelm showed the Staff Chief a further telegram he had received outlining the corrected British position and said, "Now you can do what you want." What was Grey up to? His communications with Lichnowsky, Cambon, and various British colleagues during the 1st of August are so difficult to unravel that the effort to make sense of them has produced a sub-debate within the war origins literature. On the 29th of July, Grey had warned Lichnowsky that Britain might be obliged to take swift action if Germany and France were drawn into the war. This was the warning that elicited the Kaiser's angry jottings about scoundrels and mean shopkeepers. Yet, on the 31st of July, he had also warned his ambassador in Paris, Bertie, that the British public could not be expected to support British intervention in a quarrel that was so remote from the country's own interests. Perhaps Grey really did hold up the prospect of British neutrality to Lichnowsky. That would mean that there was, in fact, no misunderstanding by Lichnowsky of his fundamental intentions. By this reading, the misunderstanding becomes Grey's way of wriggling out of the mess he had got himself into. Or perhaps he was trying to accommodate his uncertainty about whether the British cabinet would back his policy of support for France. If they did not, then the proposal of neutrality would at least offer Britain a lever by which to secure various German assurances, a promise to abstain from a preemptive attack on France, for example. Or maybe Grey was not interested in neutrality at all, but briefly came under pressure from his liberal imperialist ally, Lord Chancellor Haldane, to find a way of preventing or delaying the commencement of hostilities between France and Germany, so that there would be time better to prepare and train the British Expeditionary Force. Anxiety about the increasing fragility of the international financial markets in the last week of July may also have given him pause. Whichever view we take, and the disagreement among historians is itself telling, it is clear that Grey's ambiguities were on the verge of becoming open contradictions. To propose British neutrality, even in the face of a continental war involving France, would have amounted to a crass reversal of the positions the Foreign Secretary had earlier adopted. So much so, indeed, that it is hard to believe that this was truly his intention. On the other hand, the proposal that France and Germany should maintain an armed standoff is unambiguously instantiated in the documents. In a telegram dispatched to Bertie at 5:25 p.m. on the 1st of August, Grey himself reported that he had put it to the German ambassador that, after mobilization on the western frontier, French and German armies should remain, neither crossing the border so long as the other did not do so. I cannot say whether this would be consistent with French obligations under her alliance. But even this suggestion was bizarre, since it was based on the supposition that France might be willing to abandon the Russian alliance Poincaré recent years to reinforce. It suggests at best a very weak grip on the realities of the wider political and military situation. In any case, Grey was soon called to order by Bertie, who vented his frustration with the Foreign Secretary's speculations in a remarkably impertinent reply. I cannot imagine that in the event of Russia being at war with Austria and being attacked by Germany, it would be consistent with French obligations towards Russia to remain quiescent. If France undertook to remain so, the Germans would first attack Russians and, if they defeated them, would then turn round on the French. Am I to inquire precisely what are the obligations of the French under Franco-Russian alliance? As we know, nothing came of this curious policy option. Grey himself discarded it even before Bertie's acidic note reached the Foreign Secretary's desk. One thing we do know for sure. During he had no way of knowing whether or when the cabinet would support his pro-intervention policy, and he was being pressed in different directions by various colleagues, including the anti-interventionists of his own government, who still controlled a majority in cabinet, and the pro-interventionists of the Conservative opposition. One additional source of pressure that may help to explain the prevarications of the 1st of August was the Russian mobilization order of the 30th of July. Late in the night of the 31st, the German embassy informed London that, in response to the Russian order, Berlin had declared the state of imminent danger of war, and announced that if Russia did not immediately rescind its order of general mobilization, Germany would be obliged to mobilize its own forces, which in turn would mean war. This news sounded alarm bells in London. At 1:30 in the morning, Prime Minister Herbert Asquith and Grey's private secretary, Sir William Tyrrell, rushed to Buckingham Palace in a taxi to have the King woken so that he could send a telegram appealing to the Tsar to halt the Russian mobilization. Asquith later described the scene. The poor king was hauled from his bed, and one of my strangest experiences, and as you know I have had a good lot, was sitting with him, he in a brown dressing gown over his nightshirt and with copious signs of having been wakened from his beauty sleep, while I read the message and the proposed answer. All he did was suggest that it should be made more personal and direct by the insertion of the words, "My dear Nicky," and the addition at the end of the signature, "Georgie." The diplomatic activity intensified from dawn that morning. We might consider the impact of the news from St. Petersburg in the light of what we know of the ambivalence of Foreign Office thinking on Russia during the last months before the July crisis broke. As we have seen, Grey and Tyrrell had been rethinking the relationship with Russia for some time. In the light of continuing Russian pressure on Persia and other peripheral imperial territories, there had been talk of abandoning the Anglo-Russian Convention in favour of a more open-ended policy that would not necessarily exclude a rapprochement of some kind with Germany. This never became Foreign Office policy, but the news that Russian mobilization had just triggered German countermeasures at least temporarily foregrounded the Russian aspect of the growing crisis. British policymakers had no particular interest in or sympathy for Serbia. This was a war from the East, sparked by concerns remote from the official mind of Whitehall. Did this prompt in Grey misgivings about the Balkan inception scenario? On the morning of the 29th of July, Grey reminded Cambon, much to the latter's horror, that France was allowing herself to be drawn into a quarrel which is not hers, but in which, owing to her alliance, her honour and interest obliged her to engage. Britain, by contrast, was free of engagements and would have to decide what British interests required the government to do. Our idea, Grey added, had always been to avoid being drawn into war over a Balkan question. 2 days later, following the news of the declaration of SIDW in Berlin, he retraced the same argument, insisting, contrary to Cambon's claims, that there was no comparison between the current crisis and Agadir in 1911, when Britain had come to the support of France, because, in this case, France is being drawn into a quarrel which is not hers. When Cambon expressed great disappointment at this reply, and asked whether Britain would be ready to help France if Germany made an attack on her, Grey made his case even more pointedly. The latest news was that Russia had ordered a complete mobilization of her fleet and army. This, it seemed to me, would precipitate a crisis, and would make it appear that German mobilization was being forced by Russia. Only in the light of this perspective on events could it seem to make sense to propose a standoff between Germany and France, while Russia, abandoned by her ally, faced Germany and Austria alone in the East. If France could not take advantage of this offer, Grey told Cambon on the afternoon of the 1st of August, it was because she was bound by an alliance to which we were not parties, and of which we did not know the terms. When he wrote these words, Grey was doing more than merely cooling the temperature by withholding his support or buying time for military preparations. He was struggling with the automatism of a specific understanding of the Triple Entente, an understanding he had himself at various moments shared and articulated. It clearly unnerved him, at least at this juncture, that a remote quarrel in southeastern Europe could be accepted as the trigger for a continental war, even though none of the three Entente powers was under direct attack or threat of attack. Grey ultimately remained true to the Ententist line he had pursued since 1912, but these moments of circumspection remind us of a complicating feature of the July crisis, namely that the bitter choices between opposed options divided not only parties and cabinets, but also the minds of key decision-makers. The tribulations of Paul Cambon. These were the worst days of Paul Cambon's life. From the moment when he learned of the Austrian note to Belgrade, he was convinced that a European war was imminent. Although he had sometimes been critical of Poincaré's encouragement of Russia's Balkan commitments, he now took the view that the Franco-Russian alliance must hold firm in the face of the Austrian threat to Serbia. Indeed, he left London on the afternoon of the 25th of July in order to brief the inexperienced acting Foreign Minister Bienvenu Martin. It was probably as a consequence of Cambon's prompting that the acting minister issued the firm response to the German ambassador that so delighted Poincaré when he learned of it at sea on the 28th of July. For Cambon, just as for Wilhelm, everything depended upon Britain. If the British government puts its foot on the whole thing today, peace might be saved, he told the journalist André Giraud on the 24th of July. At a meeting with Grey early on the 28th of July, he pressed the same argument. If once it were assumed that Britain would certainly stand aside from a European war, the chance of preserving peace would be very much imperiled. Here again was that reflex deflection of responsibility that placed the onus of deciding between peace and war on another's shoulders. It was, by this reading, Britain that now carried the responsibility for preserving peace by adding its immense naval and commercial might to the balance against Berlin and thereby deterring it from supporting its ally. For years, Cambon had been telling his political masters that they could rely absolutely on British support. He was in an unenviable situation. This was not, after all, strictly speaking, a defensive war, but one in which France had been called upon to support Russia's intervention in a Balkan conflict, an obligation about which he himself had earlier expressed concern. The French government did its utmost to offset this disadvantage by scrupulously avoiding any aggressive measures against Germany. On the morning of the 30th of July, the Council of Ministers in Paris agreed that French covering troops would take positions along a line from the Vosges Mountains to Luxembourg, but without getting closer than 10 kilometres from the frontier. The idea was to avoid any possibility of border skirmishes with German patrols, and to persuade London of the pacific nature of French policy. It was felt that the moral effect and propaganda value of the exclusion zone outweighed the military risks. London was immediately notified through Cambon of the new policy. But the fact remained that Britain was not, as Grey repeatedly pointed out, a party to the alliance which supposedly obliged France to intervene, nor had it been officially apprised of the terms of that alliance. Neither Russia nor France had been attacked or placed under direct threat of attack. It was all very well for Cambon to plead with Grey that France was obliged to aid Russia in the event of her being attacked, but for the moment there was no indication that either Austria or Germany intended to attack Russia. Nor did it seem very likely that a British declaration of intention to intervene would deter the Central Powers from a policy they had embarked upon without consulting Britain. Underlying this predicament was a divergence of perspectives rooted deep in the history of the Anglo-French Entente. Cambon had always wishfully presumed that Britain, like France, viewed the Entente as an instrument for balancing and containing Germany. He failed to see that for British policymakers, the Entente served more complex objectives. It was, among other things, a means of deflecting the threat posed to the dispersed territories of the British Empire by the power best placed to do them harm, namely Russia. One likely reason for Cambon's misprision was that he came to depend too much on the assurances and advice of the permanent Under-Secretary Sir Arthur Nicholson, who was passionately attached to the Russian and the French connection, and intent on seeing both hardened into a fully-fledged alliance. But Nicholson, though influential, was not the arbiter of policy in London, and his views were increasingly out of sync with the group around Grey, who were becoming increasingly distrustful of Russia, and increasingly open to a more pro-German, or at least less anti-German, course. This is a classic example of how difficult even the best-informed contemporaries found it to read the intentions of allies and enemies. Divergences in geopolitical perspective were reinforced by the profound antipathy of the British political establishment to any form of binding commitment, an antipathy compounded by deep hostility towards Russia, especially among leading liberal radicals. The Entente Cordiale thus came to represent two rather different things to the two partners. Throughout the lifetime of the alliance, the Foreign Office sought to minimize the extent of the Entente, while the Quai d'Orsay took pains to make the very most of it. And all these dissonances were amplified by the two individuals who personified the Entente in London, Edward Grey and Paul Cambon, the former wary, evasive, and totally ignorant of France and of Europe, the latter hypertrophically French and utterly invested in the Entente, which was and remained the crowning achievement not just of his political career, but of his life as a patriot. Grey, too, was operating under narrow constraints. He failed to secure cabinet support for intervention on the 27th of July. He failed again 2 days later, when his request for a formal promise of assistance to France was supported by only four of his colleagues, Asquith, Haldane, Churchill, and Crewe. This was the meeting at which the cabinet rejected the view that Britain's status as a signatory to the 1839 Belgian Neutrality Treaty obliged it to oppose a German breach with military force. The obligation to uphold the treaty did not fall on Britain specifically, the radicals argued, but on all of the signatory powers. Should the matter arise, the cabinet resolved, the decision would be one of policy rather than legal obligation. Both the French and Russians were insisting that only a clear declaration of British solidarity with the Anglo-French alliance would persuade Germany and Austria to draw in their horns. And Grey was under pressure from his own closest colleagues. Nicholson and Eyre Crowe were both pushing him hard towards a declaration of solidarity with the Entente states. In a memorandum of the 31st of July, Crowe provided Grey with ammunition to use against his opponents in cabinet. "There might be no obligation to France," he wrote, "but Britain's moral obligation to its friend across the Channel was surely undeniable. The argument that there is no written bond binding us to France is strictly correct. There is no contractual obligation. But the Entente has been made, strengthened, put to the test, and celebrated in a manner justifying the belief that a moral bond was being forged. The whole policy of the Entente can have no meaning if it does not signify that in a just quarrel England would stand by her friends. This honourable expectation has been raised. We cannot repudiate it without exposing our good name to grave criticism." Nicholson, by contrast, focused on Belgium and the British obligation to defend its neutrality. But the conditions under which the Grey Group had made policy in the past no longer prevailed. The epicentre of the decision-making process had shifted from the Foreign Office to the Cabinet, leaving Grey's penumbra of Ententiste advisers out in the cold. After a morning Cabinet meeting on the 1st of August, Grey explained to a distraught Cambon that the Cabinet was quite simply opposed to any intervention. Cambon protested that he would not transmit this message to Paris. He would simply state that no decision had been reached. "But there was a decision," Grey retorted. Cabinet had decided that British interests were not deeply enough implicated to justify the sending of an expeditionary force to the continent. Desperate, the French ambassador shifted the ground of the argument. He reminded Grey that under the terms of the Naval Convention of 1912, France had denuded its northern ports of naval defences, in effect entrusting the security of its coastline to the Royal Navy. "Even in the absence of a formal alliance," he pleaded, "does not Britain have a moral obligation to help us? To at least give us the help of your fleet, since it is on your advice that we have sent ours away." It is rather extraordinary that Grey needed to be told this by Cambon, but the argument struck home. The Foreign Secretary acknowledged that a German attack on the French coastline and or a German violation of Belgian neutrality might alter the complexion of British public opinion. Most importantly of all, he undertook to raise the question of the French coast in cabinet on the following day. Cambon left this meeting as white as a sheet and close to tears. Staggering into the ambassador's room next to Grey's office, he was guided to a chair by Nicholson, muttering, "They are going to drop us. They are going to drop us." Britain intervenes. In fact, the position was less dire than Cambon supposed. In the crisis situation of the first days of August 1914, emotions were running high. The fear of abandonment for Cambon and the fear for Grey of being drawn out of his depth before there had been time to secure support for his policy produced a heightening and polarization of utterance that may lead us to misread the underlying realities of the situation. The balance of initiative was already shifting by imperceptible degrees in favour of a British continental intervention. On the 29th of July, the Cabinet had agreed to Churchill's request as First Lord for a precautionary mobilisation of the fleet, and on that evening Asquith managed to convey to Churchill, by means of a hard stare and a sort of grunt, his tacit consent to a deployment of the fleet to war stations. On the 1st of August, without securing the agreement of Cabinet, but with the Prime Minister's implicit approval, Churchill mobilised his fleet. At the same time, the Conservative opposition started to lobby in earnest for intervention. The Tory press had already begun to come out in favour of a British intervention, while the Manchester Guardian, the Daily News and the Standard, all Liberal organs, stuck to a policy of neutrality. The Times led the Tory papers in demanding a strong stand against Austria and Germany and participation in the imminent Continental War. And behind the scenes, the Director of Military Operations, Henry Wilson, a staunch supporter of intervention, who was often seen during these days darting between the French Embassy and the Foreign Office, alerted the Conservative leadership that Britain was in danger of abandoning France. On the 1st of August, shortly after Cambon's interview with Grey, the Conservative MP George Lloyd paid a call on the French ambassador. Cambon was still incensed. What, he asked, had become of the Anglo-French naval arrangements or the general staff consultations, both of which presupposed an interlocked security policy? And what of the many assurances of British support over recent years? All our plans have been arranged in common, the ambassador exclaimed. Our general staffs have consulted. You have seen all our schemes and preparations. Overcoming his consternation, Cambon handled his interlocutor skilfully. The Foreign Office, he said, had in effect placed the blame for its own inaction on the Conservative opposition by suggesting that the Tories could not be relied upon to support any initiative that might lead to war. Lloyd vigorously denied this and left the meeting determined to mobilise a Conservative pro-intervention lobby. A meeting took place late that night at the home of Austen Chamberlain, and by 10 o'clock the next morning, the 2nd of August, a troop of prominent Conservatives, including Lansdowne and Bonar Law, the Conservative leaders in the two Houses of Parliament, had been won over to the cause of positive action. A letter was sent to Asquith stating that the opposition would support intervention and warning that a decision for British neutrality would not only damage the country's reputation, but undermine its security. It was in the Cabinet, however, that the crucial battle would be fought. Here, opinion was still firmly on the side of non-intervention. The majority were suspicious of the Entente with France and deeply hostile to the convention with Russia. Everybody longs to stand aside, Asquith told Venetia Stanley on the 31st of July. At least three-quarters of its members, Churchill later recalled, were determined not to be drawn into a European quarrel unless Britain itself were attacked, which seemed unlikely. And the anti-interventionists could claim, with some justice, to have the support of the banking and commercial interests in London. On the 31st of July, a delegation of city financiers visited Asquith to warn him against allowing Britain to be drawn into a European conflict. The Cabinet meeting on the morning of the 1st of August brought a polarisation and clarification of views. Morley and Simon led the anti-interventionist group, calling for a declaration, now and at once, that in no circumstances would the British government take a hand. Churchill, by contrast, was very bellicose, and demanded immediate mobilisation. Grey appeared likely to resign if the Cabinet committed itself to neutrality. Haldane was diffuse and nebulous. The Cabinet decided against the immediate deployment of the British Expeditionary Force to the continent, a decision that was not opposed by Grey or the other liberal imperialists. This was the decision that plunged Paul Cambon into despair. So sure was John Morley of non-intervention that he flaunted the victory of the Peace Party before Churchill, saying, "We have beaten you after all." And yet, by the close of the following day, Sunday the 2nd of August, the British government had taken the crucial steps towards intervention. At the first cabinet meeting of that day, from 11 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon, Grey was authorized to inform the French ambassador that if the German fleet crossed the North Sea or entered the Channel in order either to disrupt French shipping or to attack the French coast, the British fleet would extend full protection. Walter Runciman, president of the Board of Agriculture and Fisheries, later described this as the cabinet which decided that war with Germany was inevitable. At a later meeting held between 6:30 and 8 p.m., it was agreed that a substantial violation of Belgian neutrality would compel us to take action. It was understood that this latter undertaking would inevitably entail intervention, since the Germans had made it clear to the British government that they intended to advance on France through Belgium. Recognizing that the writing was on the wall for the proponents of non-intervention, Burns announced his retirement after the first meeting. At the end of the second, Viscount John Morley, too, gave notice of his imminent retirement. The peace party was in disarray. How was such a dramatic reversal possible? In answering this question, it is worth noting, first, the skill with which the interventionist group set the terms of the debate. The cabinet minister Herbert Samuel helped to frame the discussion by drawing up in advance of the two meetings two formulae identifying, firstly, a German bombardment of the French coast and, secondly, a substantial violation of Belgian neutrality as potential triggers for a British armed response. Part of the appeal of these two proposals lay in the fact that they were designed to ensure that it was an action of Germany's and not of ours which would cause the failure. Grey stated at the morning meeting of the 2nd of August, with great emotion, that Britain had a moral obligation to support France in the coming conflict, adding that, "We have led France to rely upon us, and unless we support her in her agony, I cannot continue at the Foreign Office." And while the pro-interventionists gathered around Grey and the Prime Minister, the Peace Party failed to rally cross-party or extra-parliamentary support, and proved unable to generate a leader capable of challenging the imperialists and their conservative allies. How important were the arguments put forward by the liberal imperialists? Since Britain's declaration of war on Germany on the 4th of August did indeed follow upon the German invasion of Belgium, and since the Entente swiftly hardened into a fully-fledged alliance, whose history would later be rewritten as a story of abiding Anglo-French friendship, it has generally been assumed that Belgium and France were the issues that drew Cabinet, Parliament, and the British people into war. This view is not wrong. It is impossible to deny their importance both in legitimating the policy adopted and in cementing the union sacrée between the Cabinet, Parliament, and popular opinion that was such a striking feature of early wartime Britain. In a brilliantly judged speech to the House of Commons on the 3rd of August, Grey integrated the Anglo-French Entente into the emerging pro-war consensus. British undertakings to France, he said, had always stopped short of an engagement to cooperate in war. But the very fact of naval cooperation between the two countries implied a moral obligation. The French fleet is now in the Mediterranean, and the northern and western coasts of France are absolutely undefended. The French fleet being concentrated in the Mediterranean, the situation is very different from what it used to be, because the friendship which had grown up between the two countries has given them a sense of security that there was nothing to be feared from us. The French coasts are absolutely undefended. The French fleet is in the Mediterranean, and has for some years been concentrated there because of the feeling of confidence and friendship which has existed between the two countries. And to this moral calculation, Grey appended an argument from interest by suggesting that were France to withdraw its fleet from the eastern Mediterranean, Italy might seize the opportunity to depart from her own neutrality, and Britain might at some later date be forced to enter the fray in order to defend Mediterranean trade routes that were vital to this country. This was, by all accounts, the most successful speech of Grey's political career. No one who reads it today can fail to be impressed by the way in which he, in the beguilingly hesitant, gentlemanly style that was his trademark, established the moral credentials of the imperialist position. One of the most telling tributes came from the formerly anti-interventionist liberal Christopher Addison. Gray's speech satisfied, I think, all the House, with perhaps three or four exceptions, that we were compelled to participate. And once the decision was made, the nation fell in line behind it with astonishing speed, creating a British Union Sacrée that extended all the way from the Unionists of all stripes to the Labour Party and even the Irish Nationalists. Cambon's trust in the British Foreign Secretary was thus vindicated. There had been a few painful moments, to be sure, but the French ambassador was right in the longer run, and the run was only a few days long, after all. Nevertheless, the fact that neither Belgium nor France had carried much weight with the cabinet in the last days of July suggests that we need to nuance the argument and distinguish between the reasons for decisions and the arguments chosen to advertise and justify them. Other factors must have catalyzed the transition from neutrality to intervention, especially for those waverers among the ministers whose support was necessary for the passage of a cabinet resolution. Within this more circumscribed setting, party political anxieties about how the Liberal government would survive the resignation of Gray and Asquith were surely crucial. Given the support of the Conservative opposition for intervention, which was in turn powered in part by attitudes to the Irish question, the assumption being that intervention would necessitate the indefinite postponement of Home Rule, the collapse of the Liberal cabinet would simply have resulted in the slightly belated adoption of Gray's policy. For those who remained unmoved by Belgian neutrality and the Anglo-French naval arrangement, this was a powerful argument against allowing the intervention debate to break the government. Underlying these calculations were deeper concerns about the threat posed to British security by the looming conflict. Since around 1900, the need to ward off Russian menaces had been a central theme in British policymaking. In 1902, Britain had used the Anglo-Japanese alliance to balance against Russia in the Far East. The Anglo-French Entente of 1904 had further weakened Russia, at least as an opponent of Britain, and the Convention of 1907 with Russia provided, in theory at least, a means of managing tensions along an imperial periphery that Britain could no longer afford effectively to garrison. The Russian threat had not disappeared by 1914. In fact, it was resurfacing during the last year before the outbreak of war. At that time, the extremely high-handed and provocative behavior of the Russians in Persia and Central Asia encouraged some policymakers in London to believe that the Anglo-Russian Convention might be on its last legs, and others to press yet harder for an alliance with St. Petersburg. As Buchanan put it in a letter to Nicholson in April 1914, "Russia is rapidly becoming so powerful that we must retain her friendship at almost any cost. If she acquires the conviction that we are unreliable and useless as a friend, she may one day strike a bargain with Germany and resume her liberty of action on Turkey and Persia." Or, in Nicholson's more explicit formulation of 1912, "It would be far more disadvantageous to have an unfriendly France and Russia than an unfriendly Germany. Germany can give us plenty of annoyance, but it cannot really threaten any of our more important interests, while Russia especially could cause us extreme embarrassment, and indeed danger in the Mideast and on our Indian frontier, and it would be most unfortunate were we to revert to the state of things which existed before 1904 and 1907. Yet it was to contain Germany, not Russia, that Britain went to war in 1914. There has been controversy among historians about the respective impact of what appear to be two quite distinct security paradigms. While the older studies, and some newer ones, stress the centrality of the continental balance of power to British thinking and policy, recent revisionist accounts have globalized the field of vision, arguing that Britain's vulnerability as a world power obliged it to focus on Russia as the more fundamental threat. It is true that continentalist arguments acquired more weight in British thinking after the crises of 1905 and 1911, but it is misleading to overstate the tension between the two viewpoints, which were often blended in the arguments offered by decision-makers. An example is the minute appended by Herr Crowe on the 25th of July to a telegram from Ambassador Buchanan in St. Petersburg. Crowe's view was, and always had been, that of a balance of power continentalist focused on the containment of Germany. Yet he also made an explicit appeal to Britain's imperial security. Should the war come, and England stand aside, one of two things must happen. A. Either Germany and Austria win, crush France, and humiliate Russia. What will be the position of a friendless England? B. Or France and Russia win. What would then be their attitude towards England? What about India and the Mediterranean? In short, the key British decision-makers were not forced to choose between continentalist and imperial options in 1914. Whether one identified Russia or Germany as the chief threat, the outcome was the same, since British intervention on the side of the Entente offered a means both of appeasing and tethering Russia, and of opposing and containing Germany. In the conditions of 1914, the logics of global and continental security converged in the British decision to support the Entente powers against Germany and Austria. Belgium. French policy combined an offensive posture in the Russian theatre with a defensive one in their own. In Germany's case, the Poles were reversed. The need to fight on two fronts obliged German planners to seek a decisive victory first on one front and then on the other. The westward strike was given priority because it was here that the Germans expected to encounter the most determined and effective resistance. On the eastern front, in the meanwhile, a mere holding force was left to meet the Russian advance. The balance between the eastern and the western contingents changed in the last years before the war, as Moltke struggled to address the threat posed by Russian military expansion and infrastructural improvements, but the underlying logic of the plan remained the same. Germany would strike first and hardest in the west and destroy its western opponent before turning to face its enemy in the east. Since 1905, it had been assumed by German planners that military success in the West would be possible only if Germany struck at France through neutral Luxembourg and Belgium. The assault would pass along two corridors on either side of the Ardennes Forest, one leading through Luxembourg, the other squeezing around the tongue of Dutch territory known as the Maastricht Salient, to cross southern Belgium. A broad, five-armed, concentric attack into northern France would bypass the Place Forte around Verdun, Nancy, Épinal, and Belfort, enabling the German armies to threaten Paris from the northeast, and thereby to achieve a swift resolution of the conflict in the west. Moltke and his subordinates in the General Staff viewed this deployment plan as the pure expression of an incontrovertible military necessity. No alternative plans were devised that might have provided the civilian leadership with options to play with. The only alternative deployment scenario, the Eastern Campaign Plan, which envisaged a mobilization against Russia alone, was shelved in 1913. The military leaders were remarkably unconcerned about the political impact that the violation of Belgian neutrality might have on Germany's diplomatic freedom of maneuver during the crucial crisis phase between peace and war. Historians have rightly criticized the rigidity of German military planning, seeing in it the fruits of a political system in which the army pursued its own dreams of absolute destruction, free of civilian control or oversight. But there was also careful reasoning behind the narrowing of options. The increasingly interdependent defense arrangements within the Franco-Russian alliance made a war on one front virtually inconceivable, hence the abandonment of the Eastern Campaign plan. And the German military, by contrast with their French counterparts and with German civilian leaders, did not attach great importance to the question of British intervention, which was seen by most German planners as militarily irrelevant, another failure of strategic and political imagination. As the moment approached for German mobilization on the 1st of August, the policymakers in Berlin made two further epic blunders. The execution of the Western deployment plan required the swift and immediate invasion of Belgium. Delaying the violation was out of the question, Moltke argued, because the completion of Belgian defense measures in and around fortified Liège would block the German advance and cost huge casualties. This insistence on immediate action was politically problematic. Had Germany waited until its forces were actually concentrated and ready for attack before crossing the Belgian border, the Belgian and French armies would have acquired more time to consolidate their defensive arrangement. On the other hand, it would have been much harder, though probably not impossible, for Grey and his colleagues to make a case for intervention. Grey's opponents could have pointed out that Russia and, by extension, France, not Germany, were forcing the pace. The British interventionists would have been deprived of one of their most effective arguments. Recognizing this, Admiral Tirpitz, a navalist who understood the importance of the British role, later posed the angry question, "Why did we not wait?" The presentation of an ultimatum to the Belgian government on the 2nd of August was another disastrous mistake. Given the decision to breach Belgian neutrality and the pressing need for speed, it might well have been better, from Germany's point of view, simply to break into and across Belgian territory, making one's excuses as one went, and dealing with the matter afterwards as a fait accompli by means of an indemnity. This is exactly what the British government had been expecting the Germans to do. And the ministers in Asquith's cabinet, including Churchill, had repeatedly expressed the view that Britain would not necessarily regard a German transit through Belgium as a casus belli, so long as the Germans stayed south of the Sambre-Meuse line and thus kept clear of the strategically sensitive region around Antwerp and the Schelder estuary. The German civilian leaders, on the other hand, could see no alternative to an ultimatum, for this seemed the only possible way to strike a deal of some kind with Brussels and thereby keep Britain out of the war. The ultimatum, drawn up by Moltke on the 26th of July and subsequently revised by the Foreign Office in Berlin, was formulated to appeal to a reasoned Belgian appraisal of the national interest in the light of the huge imbalance in the forces engaged. The text opened by stating that the Germans believed a French attack through Belgian territory to be imminent, and that the German government would view it as a matter of the deepest regret if Belgium regarded as an act of hostility against herself the fact that the measures of Germany's opponents forced Germany, for her own protection, to enter Belgian territory. Then followed a series of points. Germany would, point one, guarantee all Belgian territory and possessions, point two, evacuate Belgian territory as soon as hostilities were completed, and point three, cover all Belgian costs and damages with a cash indemnity. Should Belgium oppose the German troops, however, point four, Germany would, to her regret, be compelled to consider Belgium as an enemy. But if this outcome were avoided, the friendly ties that bind the two neighbouring states would grow stronger and more enduring. Two telling last-minute changes were made to the note. The deadline offered for the Belgian reply was reduced from 24 to 12 hours at the request of Moltke, who was keen to get moving as quickly as possible. Second, a clause suggesting that the Belgians could, if they maintained a friendly attitude, expect territorial compensation at the cost of France, was deleted from the text because it had suddenly occurred to the Foreign Office that it might well enrage Britain even more than the intended violation of Belgian territory. That Beetman had at first failed to see this does not cast a flattering light on his political judgment at the height of the crisis. From the moment when the German minister, Bello Salesca, delivered the note to D'Avignon, the Belgian minister of foreign affairs, everything started to go horribly wrong for the Germans. Had Moltke simply barged through the south of Belgium, it might have been possible to frame the breach in terms of military expediency. But the note forced the Belgian government to articulate a principled view in advance of the anticipated action. The task of doing that fell to the Belgian king and to the head of the Belgian government, Count Charles de Broqueville. De Broqueville brought a French translation of the text with him when he went to see the king at the palace at 8 p.m. There could be no doubt about how these two would respond. The Belgian king was famed for his uprightness and resolve, and de Broqueville was a genteel, old-fashioned Belgian patriot. They viewed the note as an affront to Belgian honour. How could they have done otherwise? 1 hour later, at 9 p.m., The German ultimatum was discussed by the Council of Ministers and then by a Crown Council, at which the portfolio ministers were joined by a number of distinguished statesmen with titular ministerial titles.